FDF Awards. One of the most prestigious nights in the food and drink calendar is online 3rd of February. For details of this and other FDF events, including our online convention, visit our website, fdf.org.uk.
Thank you for rejoining us, and also thanks to our sponsor for this afternoon and in fact the whole of today, Lloyds Bank. Throughout the course of the next hour and a half, we'll be looking at a couple of topics. Firstly, the implications for food and drink regulation of the EU exit, followed by a panel discussion on the implications for the devolved administration. So firstly, my colleague Helen Gillan, our regulatory manager covering EU exit, will be taking us through a short presentation. She will then be in conversation with Pete Martin, who is the regulatory affairs director at Ashberry Labelling. After that, we will cross to the colleagues covering devolved administrations. My colleague Kat Hay, who's our policy manager for FDF Scotland, will be chairing a panel discussion with representatives from Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland. That will be Pete Robertson and Fintan O'Leary for Wales, Michael Bell from Northern Ireland Food and Drink Association, and our own colleague David Thompson, chief executive of FDF Scotland as well. So without further ado, I'll now hand over to Helen Gillan.
In my presentation today, I'm going to be providing a brief overview of food and drink regulation at the end of the transition period. I'm then going to hand over to Pete Martin from Ashberry Labelling, who will be providing practical advice on food and drink labelling. I'm sorry that some of you, this might duplicate what you've already heard this morning, but it is an important topic, and I think some people might have only joined for this session. And hopefully my presentation will answer some of the questions that have already been raised this morning. So firstly, an overview of regulatory changes at the end of the transition period. As part of the withdrawal agreement, the UK has continued to apply EU law during the transition period, and any new regulations that come into force up to and including the 31st of December 2020 will apply directly to UK law. From the 1st of January 2021, the UK will make and enforce its own rules, and there will not be automatic alignment with the UK. So any changes made to EU regulations after the end of the transition period will not be directly applicable in the UK. However, under the terms of the Northern Ireland Protocol, the majority of EU food and drink legislation will continue to apply in Northern Ireland. UK food and feed legislation will not automatically change from the 1st of January 2021. Existing EU legislation will move into UK legislation and will be known as retained EU law. This is EU law as it existed at the end of the transition period. Retained EU law has been transposed into UK law through enabling statutory instruments and devolved statutory instruments to ensure that the legislation operates correctly in a UK context. So this means that EU-centric language such as European Union has been replaced with UK and GB, and the risk assessment, risk management functions previously undertaken by EU institutions has been transferred to UK bodies. From the 1st of January 2021, risk assessments that were previously undertaken by EFSA will now be undertaken at a UK level for products placed on the GB market. So for example, EFSA will undertake approvals for regulated products such as additives, GM and novel food products. DHSC will undertake approvals for nutrition and health claims, and HSC will undertake approvals for pesticides and chemicals. Also from the 1st of January 2021, powers to legislate that were previously held by the European Commission will be returned to the UK and devolved administrations. For the UK, the powers will rely with the Secretary of State, and for the devolved issues, the Scottish and Welsh ministers. And this will be based on advice and recommendations from government departments such as DEFRA and DHSC, and other bodies such as FSA, Food Standards Scotland and HSC. With responsibilities for food and feed devolved across the four nations, FSA, Food Standards Scotland, DEFRA and DHSC have been working on common frameworks to provide a consistent approach to developing and implementing policy in areas that previously been governed by EU law and now fall within devolved competence, including food and feed safety and hygiene, food compositional standards and labelling, and nutrition claims, composition and nutrition labelling. There will be some labelling changes from the 1st of January 2021 to reflect the UK's position as a third country, i.e. a non-EU country. EU labelling rules will continue to apply in Northern Ireland, and this will result in some differences to labelling requirements in Northern Ireland compared to the rest of the UK. DEFRA's guidance on food and drink labelling changes from the 1st of January 2021 sets out the required labelling changes at the end of the transition period, and this has been recently updated to include labelling requirements for Northern Ireland. So in terms of the FBO address, for products placed on the GB market, this will be the responsible UK FBO address, or the UK importer. For products placed on the Northern Ireland market, it will be the NI or EU27 FBO address, or the NI EU27 importer. And for products placed on the EU market, it will be the EU27 or NI FBO address, or the EU27 NI importer. And this has to be the responsible FBO. So I think a question was asked earlier about whether a solicitor's address would be acceptable. My view is that wouldn't be sufficient on its own, but they probably would know how to set you up as a legal entity to meet the requirements. Also, dual addresses are acceptable, so you could have GBEU or GBNI to cover all three markets. In terms of country of origin declarations, GB food must not be labelled EU origin from the 1st of January 2021. Where EU law does not require an EU member state to be indicated, food from Northern Ireland can be labelled Origin EU or Origin UK. Where EU law does require an EU member state to be indicated, food from Northern Ireland should be labelled as United Kingdom Northern Ireland in full or UKNI. UK emblems, EU emblems and flags must not be used on GB products after the 1st of January 2021 unless EU authorised. And in terms of GI logos, the UK will set up its own GI scheme from the 1st of January 2021. GI products produced and for sale in GB must use the relevant UK logo on packaging and marketing materials. But for GI products registered before the 1st of January 2021, there is a 3-year transition period up to the 1st of January 2024. For GI products registered after the 1st of January 2021, the UK logo is mandatory. For GI products produced in Northern Ireland, it will be mandatory to continue using EU logos where the product is registered under the EU GI schemes, or optional to use the UK GI logo if the products are registered under the UK GI scheme. GI products that are protected in the EU can continue to use the EU logo in the UK after the transition period. In terms of products of animal origin, the European Commission is due to vote at the Standing Committee meeting on the 14th of December on the listing of the UK as an approved third country to allow exports of POAO to the EU and movement to Northern Ireland. So until that vote takes place, we will not know if we are allowed to export POAO. GB approved FBOs will need to be listed with the European Commission to export POAO to the EU and move such products to Northern Ireland, or if they supply others that use POAO in commodities that are exported to the EU or moved to Northern Ireland. FSA wrote to approved FBOs in July this year, stating that it would automatically put forward all approved establishments for listing with the European Commission. And I know there was a question about this earlier. So it's an opt-out rather than an opt-in list. So if you are an approved FBO, you should be on that list. FSA has recently updated its guidance on health and identification marks for POAO from January the 1st, 2021, to include guidance on the early use of the ID mark. So the current UK EC health and identification marks applied to POAO produced in the UK must be used until the 31st of December 2020. The new health and identification marks applied to POAO produced in the UK must be used from the 1st of January 2021. For GB businesses, the country code is United Kingdom in full, GB or UK, depending on the destination market. For Northern Ireland businesses, the country code is United Kingdom Northern Ireland in full or UKNI. To avoid a cliff edge scenario at the end of the year, FBOs can start using the new ID mark as long as the product remains within their control, ready for release to the EUNI market after 11 p.m. on the 31st of December 2020. If a product bearing a new ID mark is found on the EUNI market prior to the end of the transition period, it will be non-compliant with EU law and could be subject to enforcement action by the applicable EU member state. The FSA guidance also covers the rewrapping, repacking, or relabeling of products to be compliant with EU law. On organics, the first thing to mention is that the new EU organic regulation, which was due to enter into force on the 1st of January 2021, has now been postponed until the 1st of January 2022. This means that the EU and the UK remain aligned on organic rules for the next 12 months and will not diverge immediately. With this in mind, the European Commission has now voted to approve the UK's six organic control bodies to certify UK goods to EU organic rules until the 31st of December 2021. This means that if an EU-UK trade deal including organic equivalency is not agreed before the end of the year, those UK control bodies will be able to continue to certify UK goods to EU organic rules and allow for the continued export of organic products from GB to the EU and movement to Northern Ireland from the 1st of January 2021. This is a very welcome development, but we do hope that trade deal with the EU will include organic equivalence, which provides a longer term solution. We understand that a new unique reference code will be assigned to the UK organic control bodies by the European Commission as part of this approval, which will need to be included on the label for the EU and NI market. This new code can be used in addition to the existing code, and companies are advised to contact their own control bodies for details about the new codes. The EU organic logo may voluntarily be used on GB products destined for the EU market if they are certified by one of the UK organic control bodies. And DEFRA is having further discussions on whether it can be used on products only placed on the GB market or non-EU market. Finally, periods of adjustment for labelling changes. FGF has repeatedly called for periods of adjustment for labelling changes, and UK government has acknowledged that FBOs need time to adapt to these new labelling rules. For products placed on the GB market, a 21-month period of adjustment has been provided, so label changes will be required by the 30th of September 2022. For products placed on the Northern Ireland market, there will be a proportionate and risk-based approach to enforcement of the FBO address, ID marks and origin. Unfortunately for the EU market, there is currently no period of adjustment for label changes after the 1st of January 2021. However, food of non-animal origin placed on either the UK or EU market before the 1st of January 2021 can continue to circulate in both markets without labelling changes. Food of animal origin placed on the EU market before the 1st of January 2021 can continue to circulate within the EU market without labelling changes. It sets out in the withdrawal agreement that a good is placed on the market in the EU when it is first supplied for distribution, consumption, or commercial use, whether free of charge or not. My final slide sets out where further guidance is available, and I will now hand over to Pete Martin from Ashbury Labelling.
I'm Pete Martin. Background as a trading standards officer, and many years ago, and I've since worked for this side of the fence, if you like, keeping companies compliant with legislation, or if they've strayed a little bit too far away from that, just actually trying to help them get around or engage with trading standards officers. Ashbury, we've formed in 2010, specialist regulatory agency. What we do is we look after product lifecycle and labelling generally and regulatory issues globally. So we might have a client that looks after 10,000 products in one site or one country for a year, and we have some clients who might have one product but it goes to 50 different countries and anything in between. So we've got a wide variety of things going on, exposed to a wide variety of legislation. So I'm just going to come here today just to point out a few things that that you may not be aware of, or some things to bear in mind when you're looking at exporting to the EU from the outside. Like Karen's already mentioned, a few things are obvious. They've been obvious since the Brexit was actually indicated. The fact that we're no longer in the EU, so a UK address or a GB address no longer satisfies the need for a European address. So name and address must change. Health marks, identifications marks must change, obviously, as well. Organic, well, we've had a bit of a reprieve on that for a year at least, and that's going to be recognised as well. And clearly, we can't state that anything UK or UK-based or GB-based is actually EU. And we need to go around and look at the various indications of ingredients and marketing standards and so on that affects those products. So a lot of it is, I think, is relatively straightforward. It's just that there's been little decision, no decision making until quite recently, especially with the organic issue. In terms of labelling then, over the next, it's not only addressing those, and I know a lot of our clients have actually been looking at this and certainly doing it from the beginning of this year, trying to make sure all labels are amended, having two labels perhaps waiting just in case worst case happens, so that products can still be transported. In addition to this, there's also upcoming changes around the use of NATO. There's the obesity strategy in the UK, and I must say that's quite a global thing as well, as I'm sure many of you know. Lots of people looking at how to deal with obesity and the various ways of doing it, and using labelling just as one of those tools. And there's potential for front of pack changes as well. So what we're typically used to, traffic lights, the EU may change, maybe mandatory, but it could be Nutri-Score. So it could be something a little bit different. And then how do we go about addressing that? And equally in the UK, I've been recently listening to DEFRA and the FSA, and they seem to be talking about changes and about how we can actually use front of pack now to be more appropriate and more attuned to our own populace. What I'm going to do, I'm just going to highlight a few things about member states and how you need to look at labelling, just briefly run through those, some of the issues we found. Bear in mind, these are issues we found where mutual recognition existed. So principles, though, will apply regardless of whether it's going to the EU or you're going further afield, so you're going to the US, Australia, Far East, and so on. So the sorts of things we're going to be looking at, and I'll just give you an indication, is after this, I might go and have a batch for lunch. And you're probably thinking, what is that? Well, that's because I live in Coventry, and a batch, you may know as a bun, as a roll, the cob, or whatever else it might be. So within 20 miles of here, there's probably five or six different words just for that roll, that batch. Okay, so you can imagine multiplying that across the whole of the EU and the rest of the globe. So whether or not there's actual legal requirements for certain ingredients and certain products, you need to make sure that actually your product is understood in that local market. So you need to make sure, even if it's not a legal, it's, you know, composition or requirement or a standard of identity that might be in the US, that you can sell it. You want to be able to sell it. First of all, check your formulation is compliant in the target market. Hardly ever use a direct translation. Even when languages are the same, two different jurisdictions may have different approach. And essentially make sure you get the adequate regulatory advice. I'll just go through some issues just to highlight those for you. This harks back to my days as a trading standards officer when I used to go to the chip shop and used to see acetic acid and water on the counter described as vinegar, which clearly is not acceptable in the UK. But across the EU, there are some member states who accept that. And bear in mind that you have to look at these individual ingredients and look at what they might be called. And if whatever you're using might not be suitably named for another member state. Similarly, we've had issues in the past where you talk of spirit vinegar and it might be going to Middle East states. So again, it's looking at that and making sure that that name is amended, because spirit vinegar can actually stop it at port potentially. What illustrations do you have on pack? There's the ingredients for a typical product there across the top. In the UK, we'd probably accept an apple on there. In France, they'd probably accept an apple on there. But in the Netherlands and Germany, the fact that it's only natural apple flavouring, there's no actual apple puree or juice or anything else present, means that you'd have to actually add an extra statement. And you may not have space on your label, you may not want to add that extra statement because none of your competitors do in the market. So in which case then you consider removing the actual illustration as well, the pictorial. Mayonnaise, what we sell as mayonnaise here, might be something slightly different in the EU. So what are you looking at? What's on the marketplace? What do you describe it as? So mayonnaise may not suffice as the name, you may be looking at slightly different names. Similar sort of product, but this is light mayonnaise, and we know that in certain countries that doesn't exist. Perfectly legal, perfectly acceptable in GB according to the EU regulations, but again, it doesn't exist in certain other countries, so how do you want to name it? Allow it to be sold, but also allow it to not misdescribe or mislead consumers. Yogurt, quite a simple product, yet for the UK, there's no real compositional standard, but then you go to France and other countries, and there are specific requirements. So what are you selling? How are you describing it? Another issue which we're a bit surprised about, really. We were helping a client selling or labelling a product for the German market. It's a meat product, a sausage, and used by, typically used in the UK. No issues with that. Went to Germany, and the local enforcement actually insisted on the best before. And their client, or our client's client, the retailer wanted, well, they agreed with the enforcement. So we've had lots of to-ing and fro-ing over this and how that would actually work in practice. I think we've actually made some inroads at the moment, and it's gone to a higher authority who may have decided actually this isn't appropriate and use by is probably correct. But again, that's ongoing. So if it goes against us, we need to be aware of that. And for multi-country labels, we need to be labeling appropriately. France often has slightly different ways of doing things. They've banned E171 only for a year, and it looks like there's going to be further activity around E171 within Europe in the coming 6 months or so. There's a final report due out from EFSA around March. So again, it may well be that E171 isn't allowed in the future in the EU. So again, how the UK reflects that, or GB reflects that, and keeps up with that, we'll see. But it may be that it's one of these products, these ingredients or additives that just aren't generally used, regardless of legality. But then in France as well, you have recently a further requirement for origin of cocoa, above and beyond country of origin requirements you may be familiar with. And they're also looking to adopt restrictions on meat descriptions. So again, vegan, vegetarian products using certain descriptions, it'll be quite interesting to see how they're described, especially again on multi-country labels. Language, Saft, as it says there, is juice in German. So this was actually published on a German consumer website. The purchaser thought this would be juice and was disappointed to find that it was in fact a beverage concentrate, or a cordial, as we would probably call it. So again, one word, two different languages, and its unintended consequences. And it actually appeared on, a German website. So it issues with brand protection, because you don't want your brand looking bad, and you don't want to mislead consumers generally. Another example, same word, but it means two slightly different things. And as you can imagine, this product is probably likely to be sold across the Italian-German border. So again, is it misleading or not? Found not to be in this instance. I think perfectly normal, rational. And Germany and Austria. So again, same ingredients, same product. But you'll see there, hopefully you can just about see with asterisks, we've highlighted the slight difference between what's required in Germany but what's required in Austria. So, you know, two countries, same language, slightly different requirements. We also have other issues. For example, chocolate with no sugar present. So again, it was a craze over here a number of years ago. Recently seems to have come back a bit. To describe it adequately for the UK or GB market, we're looking at something like a no added sugar chocolate with sweeteners, which is typically what it might be. And you can only add sweeteners if it's a no added sugar product as defined. And yet countries like France and Belgium will look at that and say, well, you can't call it no added sugar because sweeteners are present. So again, it's the same legislation, it's across all member states, and yet there's slightly different interpretations between those member states. So that makes it quite difficult then to sell your product in all these areas without looking at it and without addressing it. But like I said at the beginning, it's making sure that you look at the formulation, you look at what you have in your product and where you want to sell it. You want to make sure it's sold. So you're looking at legal requirements, and then you're looking at customary requirements, and allowing the local consumer to understand what your product is. And to be perfectly honest, this is the situation, and it's always been the situation for a number of years now. I think the end of transition is only going to change certain of those things that Helen's already been through with you, and which are more straightforward perhaps than some of these intricacies between the various member states and the various national pieces of legislation.
The rest of the session too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you very much to both Pete and Helen for that extremely clear roundup of where we are on all things labelling. Obviously, it's brighter news slightly for organic companies now. We've been following that with some interest at the FDF Organic Group. I think just a couple of takeouts from Pete's presentation is not to leave anything to chance. I must admit, I've never thought that closely about the composition of vinegar before, and I'm certainly looking forward to trying the criminalised onion relish when I put my next order in very soon. In the meantime, we're now moving over to our devolved perspective panel, which this afternoon is chaired by my colleague Kat Hay.
I'm delighted to be joined by the panel this afternoon. I was going to kick off with kind of Northern Ireland, but I think, David, seeing as we have you here, I'll get you to kick off. I know you and I have been having a lot of wrangling with Scottish-specific issues, and perhaps you could give an overview of what's going on in Scotland, what the members have been speaking to you about, what their concerns are, that kind of thing. That'd be a great way to start.
Sure, Kat, no problem. You might want to put your mic on mute. So there's a couple of things that's important to say, I think. The first is the importance of the food and drink industry to Scotland. So it's a hugely important industry in Scotland that's recognised by the Scottish Government. And in fact, out of all the UK's food and drink exports, Scotland delivers a quarter of those. We're helped because we have whisky, but we've also got salmon, seafood, Scotch beef, and so on. And actually, it's in these areas that in particular in the kind of fresh meat and seafood areas that there are the biggest issues. Picking out Northern Ireland, which I'm sure Michael will go on to talk about in more detail, we have real concerns, even with what seems to be emerging today around protected and restricted lists. We have real issues in Scotland around meat products and preparations, including things like minced beef, and so are going to and from Northern Ireland, and there's quite a lot of trade where we send fresh meat to Northern Ireland, it's processed and then sent back to the United Kingdom. So there are key issues there. We have also key issues in particular around sheep. A lot of Irish buyers and Northern Irish buyers will buy in Scotland, keep the sheep in Scotland, and only bring them across when they need to. And there are potential issues with live animals that the farmers are particularly concerned about. A number of our members are in the seed potato business, of which Scotland has the right climate and soil to be good at. And quite a lot of potato is seeded in Scotland, grown in East Anglia, but then also taken across and grown further in Ireland. And there are enormous issues there. So in meat and in plant checks going to and from Northern Ireland, there are real concerns. In general around Brexit, I would pick up on some of those things that Scotland is well known for. So our salmon and seafood is critical to the Scottish food economy. In fact, salmon itself is often the largest food export from the UK. And in particular, getting through the short straits from Dover and Calais, from Dover to Calais, and getting to the seafood market in Boulogne is a key issue. So the biggest thing there is about time. Any extra time will reduce the profitability of your seafood. So there have been discussions around Operation Brock and how you prioritise seafood through that, and it remains to be seen how well that works. You've also got lamb, so you've got the Scotch lamb issue where a large proportion of Scottish lamb goes to France and is sold there. It will be similar for Wales, I'm sure. But massive concern in the upland sheep farmers about whether there'll be a market for their product come April and June. So those are the kind of key issues of difference with Scotland, both from the Northern Irish and from the kind of UK to EU perspective. But just to say that a number of Scottish producers share the same concerns, and that includes ingredients which are imported. So how are they going to get in? Are there key issues there? We would think of butter and other things which are used in our iconic shortbread, quite often has been imported from the Republic of Ireland. How does that work going forward? But also packaging materials and so forward. And I'm sure Pete will come on to talk about this as well, but also in terms of logistics, for normal produce, either going to and from Dover and Calais, or in Scotland, you have the Cairn Ryan port near Stranraer, which is a very small port, but carries a lot, in particular from supermarkets, who have their distribution centres in central Scotland. So, the logistics of how all that works, and in particular from our perspective at Cairn Ryan, is going to be interesting. So lots of things that are the same for most food and drink manufacturers, but a few key issues that highlight some of the differences and some of the key industries in Scotland that may be more heavily impacted than others.
That's great, David. Thank you so much. And I do see Michael there. I'm hoping Michael can both hear and see us and speak himself too. Michael, just David was mentioning Ciarán Ryan there, so perhaps let's zip across the Irish Sea to yourself. Can you outline some of the key questions that food and drink businesses are asking about Northern Ireland? I mean, you could talk for hours about this, I know, but try and kind of summarise as best you can what are the key things that are really, really concerning for those in from those in Northern Ireland.
Well, first, thanks for the invite, Captain. I hope you can hear me okay. I could summarise it all as we find ourselves at the pointy end of the stick. Agri-food is Northern Ireland's biggest enterprise. It's a quarter of our private sector. Whereas the UK imports 50% of its food, we export 80% of our food, mostly to GB. David's already highlighted that the GB to NI and the NI to GB trade are two sides of one coin. They're joined at the hip. And to think of it very simply, the economics of bringing a lorry load of food into Northern Ireland are balanced by the economics of taking a lorry load of food back from Northern Ireland into GB. So there is a bit of a tendency to think of these as two separate things. They're not. I think if I give a slightly different perspective on it, because we could spend forever in the minutiae of the detail, but from our customers' point of view, and we as an industry everywhere exist to serve our customers and feed the nation, Brexit brings the threat of increased waste, the threat of increased prices, the threat of reduced choice, the threat of damaging our integrity by creating opportunities for criminals to exploit, the threat of divergence. I don't think it has been flagged yet on this conference. The UK now becomes a dual food standard marketplace. Northern Ireland will produce EU standard foods, which have a frictionless right of access to the GB market. So from this moment forward, there will be two standards on the GB market. And then, so that dual standard issue is yet to get worked out. We've already seen the divergence, but it's how do we do divergence when both standards are going to sit on the UK market? And then last but not least, one of the points that I've been fighting on behalf of our members, and I'm sure David and the FDF team have for yours as well, is an error correction facility. It is highly unlikely that our members will be able to get everything right on day one or even in the first month or two. There's a steep learning curve here for everybody. And rather than waste food, dockside while officials try to figure out why the piece of paper was wrong, we need to have a clearing facility to allow that food to move. If we think about what's going to happen if we don't have that, we're going to be wasting good food just when the use of food banks in this nation is skyrocketing and just when a lot of people are losing their livelihoods. I think that's morally unconscionable, for both UKG and EU. We can't have that situation where we're throwing away good food or adding cost to it unnecessarily, particularly for sections of our society.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really, really good point and one that I think the governments really need to set up and take note of. Can I come back to you quickly, Michael, on what you said about divergence? How quickly do you think that will happen?
How long is a piece of string? I don't think people have got the concept. At the minute, our standards and EU standards are absolutely one and the same. There is no divergence. But as we heard from the previous speakers, there's a basket of issues. And I would also contend Europe has a very large, very sophisticated food legislation machinery, which, let's face it, churns out legislation at a rate of knots. All of us in this industry know that European rules are coming out virtually every week. It will be virtually impossible for the UK to keep up with that. It simply doesn't have the horsepower, the resources, or I could argue the interest on some of these issues. So divergence is inevitable. We as an industry are very, very clear. We want to stay at the highest possible standards. and currently those are EU. So, you know, that's where we want to be. Most of my members are essentially family companies producing high quality, fresh specialist food, mostly for the GB market. We can't compete on scale. We just can't, but we can compete on quality and integrity and freshness. And that's what we continue to. And I suspect that's true for my colleagues in Wales and Scotland as well, in particular.
Yeah, I see nodding there. If I can go back to your point as well about the clearing facility, that's a really interesting concept. What would that look like? I wonder if David and Pete might want to jump in on this as well, but I'll start with my.
Well, for those who are watching this who have ever been to Cairn Ryan, Cairn Ryan is not the biggest place in the world. It is a very small ferry terminal on the side of Loch Ryan. If we end up in a situation where Stena say, I'm sorry, you can't board that lorry because the paperwork computer says, can't go. In a very short space of time, Cairn Ryan will saturate.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't a lorry park for hundreds of lorries. I suspect Cairn Ryan might be able to deal with 10 or 20 parked up, but that's about it. So this will go from being a minor inconvenience to being a major issue very, very quickly. And as we all know, fresh food, just in time, our retailer colleagues, in order to run their businesses, need us to deliver in a very efficient and spot-on fashion. And very quickly, these goods will become non-acceptable if they've had to sit and wait for a day to get on the next ferry the next day or whatever it happens to be. And that's just going to drive waste. And I think that's obscene, to be driving waste through essentially politics for no good reason.
And I think we'd say the same on this side of the Irish Sea, that the port is no better equipped to deal with that, of what Laurie's backing up as well. I don't know if David, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, sure. Just to agree with Michael, the port on the Scottish side is essentially on the side of a loch, so it goes like that. It's there's no flat land very close there. So yeah, and we've been discussing with the Scottish Government because they'll be responsible for the bits of road and infrastructure to get there. What they're doing, I wish I had a lot of confidence in it. And as Michael says, anything that can facilitate quick movement through there would be great, and it requires working between the UK government's border forces and so on, and HMRC and the Scottish government. And so far over the whole Brexit process, it hasn't been perhaps as streamlined as we would like it to be.
I kind of, and a little bit like Pete approaches things very much from his background, I'm very much, my background is commercial, and what Leverkusen do for companies is generally sales and marketing orientated. So I'm really keen to, when I'm talking to clients, I'm here keen to hear their insights about what their experiences are with the retailers and the buyers at the moment. And so I suppose I'll deal with that in two ways, from the perspective of larger SMEs and large companies that supply retail, and then maybe from the perspective of the very large cohort of micros and small companies that are out there. So if you take medium to large companies first, I mean, we deal with clients both sides of the Irish Sea, north and south of the border, and we have a good 360 degree vantage point of what I think Michael called two sides of the same coin. Many of those are in fresh foods, and they supply UK retailers, so experiencing much also of what David highlighted earlier. Many of these companies have been preparing for Brexit for some time, as you'd expect, some in real depth and some less intense. But a key learning for me throughout from this cohort since COVID is that Brexit as a thing for buyers to be concerned about has taken a back seat to supply chain resilience, keeping their workforce safe from COVID-19, price competitiveness, for example, in response to Tesco and Aldi price match, and also things like encouraging producers to develop more sustainable packaging. These are all things that are massively high on buyers' agendas. So when we've been talking to producers recently around where does Brexit sit, well, throughout COVID-19, it's been one of many priorities, okay? And even now, Christmas, is almost more of a priority. Well, possibly up until Tesco's stirring the pot yesterday in terms of talking about stockpiling. I think that's been a welcome reminder that Brexit is absolutely here. In terms of the engagement that there has been with suppliers, you know, some of them have been fielding online questionnaires from retailers about their readiness for Brexit, but it's been pretty low key. Clearly, the origin of goods issue in terms of Northern Ireland has been on the radar. It's been referred to again by David this morning. But to an extent, I think there's been announcements about that yesterday in terms of the 3 to 6 window, 6 month window, which will help abate that somewhat. And so all in all, I suppose, I think this cohort is expecting that this large SMEs and large companies, I think, can expect Brexit to rise in the list of buyer priorities probably in the coming days and the coming week. And I think the view from our producers is that, you know, price discussions, they're expecting tough price discussions. Large kind of larger cohort. But I think I'd like to kind of present a case from a micro to small companies as well. We, Leverkusen, run a very successful drinks cluster in partnership with the Welsh Government. We've got 150 members across the full gamut of drinks, beer and cider, wine and spirits, water and soft drinks, hot drinks. And we've been having virtual meetings with them twice a month since COVID began. And we've been putting Brexit on the agenda in those discussions, but concerns about Brexit are not high for this cohort. What's particularly on their agenda is capitalizing on trends that have grown stronger during COVID, like sales of online. And for example, currently we're running a campaign called Welsh Drinks Christmas, which is aiming to persuade Welsh consumers to buy local products. You know, so that kind of gives you an example of what their priorities are. We have a concern about this, as do Welsh Government, because, you know, we want all producers to be really preparing for Brexit. But, you know, it's fairly indicative, what I've described is fairly indicative of what it means to be, I suppose, a UK food and drink micro company, small company. And many of them are trying to ride out, you know, when you ask yourself why that is, many of them are trying to ride out the near closure of the hospitality sector. Many of them will have staff furloughed until March. Many don't export, or if they do, it's a small amount and part of only a balanced portfolio. And of course, you know, they are aware of labelling change requirements and are acting on those. Some will import hops, other ingredients and packaging. And some, of course, and yeah, some are conscious of being disrupted at port. Most of them don't supply large retailers or large pub chains, who still prefer to supply mass-produced drinks from household brands, and who dominate category management discussions with retailers and have more supply chain efficiencies. So, to conclude on that question, Kat, these guys, you know, they're more focused on bursting the gut to win more customers in our local and home market, developing online direct-to-consumer sales, winning at Christmas, surviving winter, planning for a successful summer 2020. So, you know, Brexit seems less of an issue for them. And I think this will apply for food companies as well as drinks in the small and micro sector.
So there's definitely some areas of opportunity there for people who perhaps are seeing, may see current supply chains maybe change fundamentally. There's definitely opportunities to look local.
As Michael said earlier, the UK is 50% self-sufficient, whereas Northern Ireland and some of the other regional devolved economies, particularly Northern Ireland, export 80%. So if you're based in Wales, or if you're based in the UK, or within a regional economy, you know, you have loads to go at within the four walls of your own country or the four walls of the UK. And so absolutely, there is opportunity for those, and they are less impacted by, maybe compared to some of the bigger producers.
So what is something to yourself, Michael and David, if you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, I mean, Fintan makes some very good points. I just pick up. The reverse is true. So the home market in Northern Ireland is only 2 million. We actually feed 10 million people, mostly in GB. And one of my one-liners, which I'll, you know, David's been mentioning his whiskey, I'll mention the fact that we produce more dairy product than Scotland and Wales put together. So Northern Ireland is a significant supplier. One of the problems with that was the point that Pete was raising. Much of Northern Ireland food and drink is actually transshipped through Dublin Holyhead. And if you look at it on a map, it makes perfect sense. But it does create some new issues, which we still haven't actually got answers to, and we're trying to get answers for our members. And then another interesting wrinkle a third of Northern Ireland's liquid milk output ex-farm is actually processed in the Republic of Ireland. So we're going to have Irish butter going into GB made with Northern Irish milk. So the labelling on that's going to get interesting. We're hoping we're going to get some more granularity and detail coming out in the next number of days. Somebody asked me recently what Mr. Gove's statement meant. I said, the fog has cleared slightly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think from all the conversations that I know Michael and David and others have been involved in, you know, there's been much conversations about the fog is lifting, but it's definitely still there. Michael, I know we were kind of catching up earlier in the week about some of the areas that there isn't that clarity on. Where are the key areas that you're just, you know, you really, really need the government to focus in on now and get some clarity for your businesses in Northern Ireland?
That transshipping one, if we're going to have to use bonds, that's obviously ties up money. That makes the route less attractive. I attended a Shankar Singham TSS meeting. We did a major meeting for our members. I have to say, if you're not well versed in customs, I thought we were bad for acronyms, or the civil service was bad for acronyms. Customs is in a league of its own. So there's another, there is a new language, new procedures, new problems. And for small family companies, they need to outsource that. Now, we have some assistance in Northern Ireland through TSS for a couple of years. But the question then arises, well, what happens? You know, are we simply just pushing this away? So we're fighting very hard to try and get support that is permanent and that companies aren't disadvantaged going forward. And I'm quite happy to go on the record and say, I think for David's members, it's manifestly unfair that they have to use ISPM 15 pallets to sell into Northern Ireland. I mean, that's just crazy in my book. And why we can't get to an agreement on that, I don't know.
I'm going to bring David in here. Do you think that's feasible between now and the end of the transition? Do you think we can do that? Especially when I've heard more about pallets in the last year than I ever thought was possible, as have all, I'm sure, many of the listeners.
So this is the heat-treated pallet issue, which has been a cause celebre for a while, and European regulation means that you need to have any wooden pallets have to go through a certain process to be heat-treated to, I guess, avoid disease moving across. And yes, I mean, it's ludicrous where you have Northern Ireland to Scotland, which doesn't take very long. And most of the people are the same on both sides of the border, and you have this issue. Whether it can be solved or not, it's been one of those issues that hasn't seemed to have an obvious solution as far as we can see. So it's all a bit difficult. And just to pick up on some of the other points, Kat, if I may.
Yep.
I think we were talking with colleagues in Scotland earlier on today about, you know, what our disaster plan is if there's no deal and things go terribly bad. And yes, I mean, the obvious thing is to push Eat Local campaigns to try and get people in Scotland more interested in buying from Scottish producers. But, you know, anyone who's in one of the devolved nations is essentially looking at England as the largest market. And so anything that we do has to have, has to move things across and make sure that everyone in the UK is enjoying food from the UK as much as possible. That's useful in the short term, but I think in the longer term, as trade patterns will change, as the rules change, as businesses change, then we're up for a significant amount of turbulence, I think, really no matter what happens with a deal or no deal over the next few years as businesses adjust to what the new normal is, whether that's new trading patterns, new trading partners, or new regulations, as Michael has rightly pointed out.
For the viewers who don't like cold, wet weather and going north, Scotland and Northern Ireland are 12 miles apart at their closest points.
Yes. Discussions about Boris's bridge and whether you think that a good thing or a bad thing, we'll perhaps leave that for a different day. I suppose, again, because this is a practical session, so in terms of short-term support and medium-term support, where should the listeners be going if they're thinking about getting Brexit ready? I mean, we've seen the adverts on TV, but from your perspective, David and Michael, where should businesses be going to ask these key questions and to make sure they're ready for sources of support and help?
Yeah, well, from a Scottish perspective, there's a couple of things. Obviously, firstly, an advert for FDF, but you're on an FDF Brexit webinar. So, of course, as a trade association, whether you're a member of ourselves or any of the other trade associations, it's really important that you're talking to that association to get the latest information. In Scotland, Scottish Enterprise have a prepareforbrexit.scot website, which is apparently getting lots of good hits. And they have specialist food and drink support for difficult questions in there. And also, amongst all UK trade associations, there is a shared resource called the EU Exit Food Hub, which seeks to interpret, in simple terms, government guidance. So all of those are things that the FDF supports, and hopefully will provide as much information as we can, up to date. And if you're an FDF member, obviously, you get to ask the team their take on things. So there's a whole range of support to get businesses ready. And if there's any message that I have, for goodness sake, don't wait on whatever comes out of the politicians. Make sure you're in as good a state as possible now for any eventuality.
Yeah, I mean, I underline everything David's saying. So I'm not FDF, we're a separate organisation, but we work extremely closely together because we both want to see the trade continue for both sets of manufacturers on both sides of the Irish Sea as much as possible. So we share a lot of information and help each other as much as we can. It maybe says is obvious to say, but it maybe needs said.
From a Wales perspective, we are heavily involved in that community, and Welsh Government is similar to what's happening in Scotland. Northern Ireland is has a huge array of supports for Welsh food and drink producers. I'm just looking at an email here, about a webinar. There's weekly webinars about how it's affecting exporters. There's one next Monday, for example, about the Trader Support Service. It's spectacular what's available to producers, and there's newsletters going out on a regular basis, and of course a lot of people are tuned into the .gov websites, etc. as well, so I would say there's every opportunity there for producers to be as clued up about Brexit as they want to. One of the problems is obviously getting through the detail for all of us, but the help is there.
Thank you for listening to this FDF podcast. FDF is the voice of the food and drink industry, supporting our members with the expertise to develop, grow, and strengthen their business. To learn more about how we can help your business, contact us at members.inquiries@fdf.org.uk. There's no better time to become an FDF member.